Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
Welcome to this week's episode of Money Tree Investing Podcast. My name's Kirk Chisholm, and I will be your host today. So today we have a special guest. We have Rick Rule. How are you doing today, Rick?
Life is good, Kirk. Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, well, thanks for coming on, Rick. This is actually a real treat for me because I've known of Rick for probably most of my career as a wealth manager. And I followed his, and his has been quite successful. So I'm glad we had a chance to bring him on and entertain all the listeners and educate you all in the area of natural resources and precious metals. So maybe, Rick, you can tell the listeners a little about your background. I know you're kind of humble, but maybe you can spice it up a little bit and tell them about your less than humble career.
Well, I sort of think it's tough to make my life seem spicy, but I'll try. I'm 67 years of age. I've been involved in the investment business, specifically around natural resources and precious metals, and to a lesser degree, financial services, insurance businesses, banks, things like that, really for almost 50 years, 40-something years. When I say tough to make it spicy, I was a guy who decided what he wanted to do in life fairly early and never changed. So you're not going to see a lot of drama in terms of career change. I would say that the principal piece of wisdom I have to impart is that if you're going to participate in precious metals and natural resources, that you understand that they're cyclical and capital intensive businesses. And my slogan there is you have to be a contrarian or you're going to be a victim. One other little pearl, if that's the right thing, of wisdom before we start too much, is that in my own experience, people who invest generally don't pay as much attention to their investments and what the value proposition is and the time required to enjoy that value harvest. Investors these days seem to have a very, very short time frames set more by preference than reality. And if you invest in a proposition that's likely to take 3 to 5 years to pan out, and you give yourself a quarter, you're setting yourself up to failure. So I guess the sense that I'm telling people that they have to do things that are unpopular and they have to do it over a very long time contradicts your instruction to be exciting or colorful.
Yeah, well, let's talk about being a contrarian, because I think that's it's a great topic to hit on. You know, a lot of people talk about being a contrarian and contrarian investing, but what does that mean to you?
It means simply following Warren Buffett's advice that he became a billionaire by being brave when other people were afraid and afraid while other people are brave. Another famous maxim is buy straw hats in winter. Now, the truth is that in the winter, when the sun isn't shining, the need for a straw hat is not particularly apparent. Meanwhile, competition for straw hats is very limited. So buying things when the need for them is not necessarily immediately apparent. And when there isn't very much competition is what that's all about. If you dial back our experience, probably before many of your listeners were cognizant, but as an example to the early part of the 1980s, the U.S. equities had been in effectively a bear market for 10 or 12 years. Nobody wanted to be in equities. In fact, Business Week magazine had a cover called The Death of Equities, suggesting that U.S. equities market would never recover. Of course, beginning in 1982, we went into a bull market that has only been technically interrupted ever since. So the ability to understand that when equities are extremely cheap, that one needs to play is concurrent with other sort of classifications. One example of a contrarian would be if you were a general securities investor right now to look at China, coronavirus, trade sanctions, hostility in Hong Kong. When everything in the near term is wrong and when the securities are marked down by 2/3, the contrarian investor looks beyond coronavirus to the largest market and the most efficient industrial giant on earth and tries to juxtapose rationally risk to reward. In other words, you look at the headline for opportunity rather than for fear. Conversely, if you have a circumstance where everything has gone right and the price action in a market justifies the narrative, which is a different way of saying that while the story is comfortable, it's fully priced, that you have the good sense to take your leave.
So how do you come to grips with that, right? Because that's we're talking about human emotions, which is what drives the market, fear and greed. And if it was easy, everybody would do it. So how do you come to grips with the fact that you're buying these, in some cases, probably bombed out assets that nobody wants to touch? And, you know, you're seeing the value there and everyone else is running for the hills. How do you kind of manage your emotions in that way?
Well, three comments. The first of all is that I don't always succeed. Although I talk a good story, I struggle with it constantly myself. The second is that I'm very cognizant after 45 years of being an investor and after having read Ben Graham's classic, The Intelligent Investor, in my youth, I'm very cognizant of the fact that money's made on the delta between price and value. Price information around a stock is easy to acquire. You just get it from the computer. But the price information, I would suggest, only has utility to you if you have an opinion of the value. Is a $10 stock expensive or cheap? Well, that depends on what you think the company is worth and what the company is likely to be worth. And I would say that the primary mistake that most investors make, whether or not they have a value orientation or a contrarian orientation, is that they don't spend anywhere near enough time trying to develop an opinion of the value of the company that they hold itself. The third is, and this is going to be a bit more difficult to explain, I've come to favor questions where the unanswered question around the investment, where the mystery has a handle attached to it that's a when handle, not an if handle. In many types of speculation, as an example, technology or emerging technologies, the bet that you're making is if this happens, then this will happen. I prefer as an investor to ask myself questions where the unanswered question begins with when. In other words, this outcome is a certainty. I just don't know when it will occur. And we can get into that later in the interview. But the wonderful thing about extractive industries and resource industries is that there are a series of questions that are frequently asked of you over the course of a decade where the answer necessarily begins with when. And when you understand, first of all, that price is important only after you've established value, and secondly, that there are a series of circumstances where outcomes are highly predictable, but the timing is out of question, it becomes easier to be a contrarian.
Yeah, no, I appreciate the when question. And one of the things that I also want to talk about, just kind of set the stage, because you also mentioned cyclical investing. How do you see cyclical investing? Because natural resources is definitely cyclical. So what does that mean to you?
Let's jump right into that. Natural resource businesses are capital intensive, which amplifies the cyclicality. And the cyclicality that natural resource businesses are exposed to are varied. The interest rate cycle, the business cycle, political cycles. But most importantly, because the businesses are so capital intensive, that very cyclicality is amplified. Let's say, as an example, that the copper price goes up by 50 or 60%. In a normal business, when the price of a product goes up that much, the producers of the product can produce more to meet the demand that has caused the price to go up. In the case of copper or most other mineral or energy commodities, the lead times associated with increasing production are very long and very capital intensive. So although the copper price has gone from, say, $250 US to $375 US, production doesn't increase to fulfill unmet demand, because you have to go out and permit a project, which can take 5 or 6 years. You have to build the project, which can take 3 or 4 years. You have to finance the project, which may take $5 or $6 billion. So circumstances happen where the price escalations are greater than would occur in other businesses. Simultaneously, when that production finally comes online, both your production and other people's production, and supply increases rapidly, then prices fall. Because the companies have such extraordinary capital commitments involved in their productive capacity, they are loath to cut production in the face of lower prices. They produce all the way through the total cost of production, all the way down to the marginal cost of production. That means that natural resource businesses go into exaggerated bull markets and exaggerated bear markets. The truth is that when natural resource businesses seem expensive, that is, when their price earnings ratio and enterprise value to EBIT ratios are very high so that they seem expensive, they're often expensive because the commodity price is unsustainably low. So while they seem expensive according to normal metrics, they're cheap. Similarly, when commodity prices are high, these companies are gushing cash. Their price earnings ratios are low. Their EBIT to enterprise value is very low as a consequence of unnormally high commodity prices. So in order to understand the cyclicality, you have to understand something about the commodity price relative to the industry average cost of production and how efficient the average industry participant is. A simple concept, a treacherous explanation.
No, I love it. I love your explanation. And it brings up a really interesting question, which is, if this is the case, because most people look at normal metrics to value companies, and of course, natural resource companies are a little bit different. If this skewing of the numbers is giving people kind of a false sense of security from a fundamental analysis, how do you actually value them?
I think there's four steps one needs to undergo. Understanding that net present value is the ultimate consideration, but net present value involves a lot of assumptions. I start by being particularly interested in industries that are in effect in liquidation, where the product that they provide is necessary for the continued existence of the lifestyle of mankind. Let's look at oil and gas as an example. Despite the fact that some of your listeners may drive Tesla, the most important transportation fuel in front of us for at least 20 and probably 30 years is oil. So ongoing demand for oil, Greta Thunberg and the World Economic Forum notwithstanding, is oil. The International Energy Agency suggests that the fully loaded cost to produce a barrel of oil worldwide is about $60 a barrel. Importantly, this includes cost of capital, discovery cost, prior year write-downs, tax, all that stuff, the fully loaded price. So today, oil is about $50 a barrel. That means that the industry worldwide, efficient and inefficient producers lumped together, produce the stuff for $60 a barrel, sell it for $50 a barrel, lose $10 a barrel, 100 million times a day, and try and make it up on volume. This gets fairly boring over time, and to the extent that the selling price of the commodity stays below the price paid to create the commodity, new production isn't added, despite the fact that everybody's oil wells are depleting and sustaining capital investments aren't made, which necessarily reduces supply so that supply contracts to meet demand, and hence price equilibrium is restored. So I start by looking for industries that produce a product that will have demand for 20 or 30 years, where the industry average cost of production is greater than the price received by the industry for its production. Your listeners, in terms of turning themselves into a contrarian around the oil price, need to ask them, not so much now, but if the price goes lower, say $45 a barrel or $40 a barrel, and panic ensues in the oil market, they need to ask themselves this question. When I walk from my bedroom to my garage, I get in my car and I turn my key to the right, in 5 years from now or 6 years from now, will my car start? Yes or no? Because if the answer to that question is yes, then what you are saying is that the price of oil will return to a price that's necessary for the industry to earn its cost of capital. Otherwise, there will be no oil to make gasoline to put in your car. It really, truly is as simple as that. Now, hopefully, as a contrarian, the near-term circumstance is more dire. In other words, if the industry is simply in liquidation, that's one thing. If the industry is in liquidation and the industry is hated, that's better yet. It's difficult to make your brain override your heart. If you're sitting watching the nightly news and you're considering investing in China while the streets are deserted and the coronavirus is running rampant and killing people, or if you're watching the nightly news and you understand that the oil companies are losing more money than they used to, but you're also listening to a world-class expert on economics and sociology like Greta Thunberg telling you that the oil industry is destroying the world, you can be reasonably comfortable that all that over time you're involved in a good investment or speculation from a cyclical contrarian viewpoint.
You know, obviously being a contrarian requires an iron stomach a little bit. So how do you know that you're buying it at a good price versus, as we call it, catching a falling knife? Like, how do you make that distinction?
You know, I've caught a lot of knives in my world, in my life. Truth is.
You never told me you were in the carnival, Rick.
You know, again, I'll defer to Buffett. Buffett says that you shouldn't buy a share in the company if you were able, be willing to buy every share in the company at the same price you paid for the first share. Further to that, he said that before you buy a share, you should be delighted to see the share price fall 30% the month after you bought it so that you could buy more shares at a discount using the same intellectual capital that you employed to buy the first share. Now, sadly, Kirk, I've been tested by that thesis dozens of times in my career. The truth is that many, many, many times I have come to a conclusion about the trend in the commodity or the affairs of a specific company, and I have bought shares only to see myself be early and the share price fall. But fortunes are made over longer periods of time than most speculators would prefer. And the truth is, when I look back over my career, the decisions that have been good decisions but early, where I have been, depending on your point of view, forced to or allowed to buy more stock subsequent to my initial purchase at lower prices, those are the ones that have worked out the very, very, very best for me, particularly by way in speculations rather than investments. When I look back over a 40-year career and I look at the speculations that I've had that have made me tenfold returns, that is 1,000% returns, and fortunately, I've enjoyed many, I can't think of many where over the course of time that I have held the stock, that the stock hasn't declined 30 or 40 or 50% in value. If I was shaken out of the thesis by price declines, I would have deprived myself of what is frankly probably the majority of my current net worth.
So, you know, it kind of brings up the question, because there's obviously a difference of opinion from other smart investors. And what you're saying, I 100% agree. But then there's this other side of it, which is, you know, how do you know buying lower, doubling down, if you will, versus being wrong? Where do you draw the line? Like, well, maybe my thesis was wrong, or maybe I'm way too early. How do you consider that when you're kind of looking at this investment?
I have lots of experience with both outcomes, having made as many investments as I over the years that I've been involved. I've certainly made a lot of outright mistakes. Mercifully, the arithmetic of investing means that if you stick with it, the amount of money that you can make with a good investment greatly exceeds the amount you can lose. You can lose precisely 100%, unless, of course, you're wrong on margin. But the most you can make is sort of unlimited. So you need to recognize at the beginning of the process that the arithmetic favors you on the long side. But I would say that the most important thing is to pay some attention to why you make an investment. Too many investors follow the thesis, got a hunch, bet a bunch. And that's not sufficient. If you don't have an opinion, first of all, as to the current value of the investment, and secondly, to the probable value that you see 3 years from now or 5 years from now, you shouldn't make the investment. If you have no way to calibrate what your likely downside would be and what the catalysts that would cause you to recognize the downside would be, and similarly, if you have no targets and no ideas about the catalysts that will allow you to achieve your targets, you shouldn't be an active investor.
So I guess everyone's got their thesis on this, but let's talk about because I think it's going to help the listeners, because, you know, we've heard people from both sides. So I appreciate your point of view, because I think it's valuable. And if you're right, the arithmetic certainly works out in your favor. But I think the question is, and maybe hearing some stories, can you talk about some of these, some of your, maybe some wins and maybe some losses, give people some perspective? I don't know what your
give you the most dramatic story.
Okay.
And it teaches all kinds of lessons. Now, this is a speculative story, not an investment story. This is a very, very speculative story. In about 1998, I figured out that the uranium price had to go higher. At that point in time, uranium supplied about 20% of United States baseload power. At the same time, uranium was selling for $8 or $9 a pound, and it was costing the industry $25 or $30 a pound to make it. So the industry was losing in excess of 60% of the selling price of uranium, which is to say that either the uranium price had to go up or the lights were going to go out. I knew which circumstance was more likely. From a contrarian standpoint, all of the psychological factors were in place, which is to say nobody had made money in uranium for 20 years since Three Mile Island. So nobody cared. But it was better than that. When I talked about my uranium thesis in a public forum, speculators were actively hostile. They said that I was attempting to profit from Hiroshima, Nagasaki, Chernobyl, and Three Mile Island. So I knew that I was in an uncrowded trade, so uncrowded that I was by myself. And I looked around for a uranium speculation to make, and I found what seemed to me to be the ideal uranium speculation, a little tiny penny stock that nobody had ever heard of in Australia called Paladin Resources, led by a man named John Borshoff, who was an encyclopedia personally around uranium and possessed in this company one of the best uranium-based databases in the world. This is a company that had a market capitalization of $1.8 million U.S. dollars, which is to say it was basically free. I negotiated a private placement on behalf of myself and others. And if my memory serves me well, we put $2 million into a company with a market capitalization of $1.8 million, and we got a full warrant. And we made that investment at 10 cents. I couldn't interest most of my clients into that, but I was able to get my very, very best clients into that, an opportunity and a risk, of course. I was rewarded for my genius by seeing the 10-cent stock first go to 12, felt good, then 10, not bad, 8, no cause for panic, 7, uncomfortable, 5, quite uncomfortable, 4, 3, 2, 1. If you have a 10-cent investment that has brought in most of your best clients on your say-so, and the investment has gone from 10 cents to 1 cent, you are not faced with a hold or sell decision. You're faced with a buy or sell decision. And so I revisited all of my premises, every single premise, and came to the conclusion that I was right and the market was wrong. That meant that we began to buy more stock, a fair bit of stock at the 1.5 cent level. So I had my faith tested. I was certainly early. I revisited my premise. The consequence of my being early rather than wrong was that over the next 5 years, that stock went from 1.5 cents, or less charitably, 10 cents, which was my buy price, to $10. The single best response from a speculation of my career. What that involved was understanding the value inherent in the investment I made, which is to say, understanding the economic probability of loss ultimately, but more importantly, understanding the probabilities around my gain. In this circumstance, I wasn't wrong, but I was 18 extraordinarily uncomfortable months early.
So that actually brings up an interesting point, because this has come up a few times with some other institutional investors where, you know, drawing the line between being early and being wrong can be very uncomfortable. I mean, Jeremy Grantham at GMO was early twice, and the investors he had considered him to be wrong. Eventually, he was right. So there's a time value aspect of this too. So how do you kind of look at that with the natural resource space if you're early versus being wrong?
If you're concerned about time value of money, one of the things that you can do is give up part of your upside by capturing back your downside, which is to say that you can participate in an unpopular sector, if it's a broad sector, through owning the bonds or owning convertible preferreds. The yields associated with convertible preferreds often mean that you don't capture all the upside, but you take away the time value of money objection. What's important to know about natural resources is that they are so extraordinarily cyclical, which is to say that when they go into bull markets, the capital gains that you make are usually so extraordinary that those gains themselves address time value of money if you have the courage of your convictions. It's important, however, that the investor understand himself or herself. This isn't a strategy that's particularly attractive to traders whose way of beating the knowledge has to do with their own understanding of how to monetize a narrative in a market. This isn't a trading strategy. This is an investment strategy. In other words, this is more about the book Securities Analysis or The Intelligent Investor than it is about the book Battlefield of Investment Survival. You know, it's a very different technique, both of which are useful. But my own investing is shaped very much by fundamental analysis and by credit analysis. In other words, I'm very much a bottoms-up fundamental investor.
Yeah, no, I could tell, and it's great. I think, you know, in the space that you're in, you obviously need to have an edge. And I think a lot of investors just hear a story, right? They hear a good story about how there's a gold mine there, or there's some other aspect that's really attractive, and they're going to get 100% or a few 100% returns on their money. And you're taking a more fundamental analysis, which I think, at least from my experience, from what I've seen, very few people are actually doing. What have you seen in that space? Because it seems like there's a lot of misdirection and maybe misinformation in that space that causes people down the wrong road.
Yeah, I think part of it is investor perception. More people need to employ common sense, particularly in this day when newsletter marketing is A, so prevalent, and B, so hyperbolic. I mean, we've all seen things in our inbox that say, make 609% by the next long weekend. Gold stock goes ballistic. While that copy might be attractive in your wildest dreams, common sense tells you that it's highly unlikely to be true. Many, many people confuse a broad industry narrative with a fundamental. I've had hundreds of people in conferences in my question and answer sessions say, Rick, if the gold price were to go from $1,500 to $2,000, what do you think the impact on Amalgamated Moose Pasture Exploration might be? And I have to say, the problem with your thesis is that Amalgamated Moose Pasture doesn't have any gold. They're looking for gold. And if the price of something that you have goes up, but you don't have any, it has no impact whatsoever on the fundamental value. Too often, as I say, investors and speculators are unwilling, not that they're unable, because they're not unable, they're unwilling to do the work required to understand their investment. Let me give you another illustration, Kirk, that might help some of your listeners, particularly your female listeners, and I hate to be politically incorrect, understand this. If your listeners walked into a shopping mall and they were shopping for a coat, and they thought that a reasonable price for a winter coat of reasonable quality was $250. And they walked into a very flashy, flash store, bespoke. And this coat that they thought was probably worth $250 was available for $500 or $600. But most of your rational listeners would thank the salesman and leave. Walking down that same mall, looking on the left side of the mall, there's a discount store, and a decent quality coat is on sale for $150 relative to their price expectation of $250. They, of course, buy the coat and they're delighted. That same sort of rational understanding of approximate value doesn't carry as well into financial goods as it does physical goods. And if people would shop for financial goods with the same expectation of utility that they shop for physical goods, my suspicion is that the outcomes would be far better for them.
Yeah, I would agree. I think from my experience, a lot of that is people mistaking value for price.
Correct.
And looking at the price and saying, oh, well, it's gone down, so it must be a better value. When
or it may worse. Not be.
Right.
Worse. I mean, if you think about it, if a stock is $10 and you think it's worth $10 and nothing changes and the stock gets marked down to five, arithmetically, it's twice as attractive. Similarly, if a stock is $10 and you think it's appropriately priced and nothing changes and it goes up to 20, arithmetically, it's half as attractive. You don't feel as good about a $10 stock at five, and you feel better about a $10 stock at 20. But the truth is, the arithmetic, if nothing fundamental has changed and the price falls in half, is that it's twice as attractive. If the price doubles, it's half as attractive. Substituting arithmetic for your psyche is, of course, hard to do, but it's necessary too.
Well, there's the other piece of this too, which I find a lot, which is somebody can look at a company like Tesla, who knows where the price is today or when this podcast comes out after the rocket ride it took up. And then, you know, it's a few hundred dollars. And then you look at, you know, maybe like a natural resource stock that's trading for 20 cents. And, you know, they look at that and say, well, the 20 cent one, that means it'll be easier for me to, they're comparing it to Tesla saying, well, just think if it goes up to $300.
Correct.
And they look at the price as equivalent across the board, and every stock is compared on value based on price. And I see that a lot.
That's exactly right, Kirk. The price information only has utility if you have an opinion about value. Money is made in the delta between price and value.
So I wanted to talk about a few things here. So first, you had mentioned a little while ago about private placements. So you negotiate a private placement. I know that it's not something that we do a lot of, but it's something that I'm aware of, that if you're, as they say, you're in the room at the time, you tend to get the best deals. And I know you're one of those guys who's always in the room. So can you talk about private placements and how those work and how that can amplify investors' returns?
Yeah, in a broad sense. And first of all, we need to disclaim that private placements are limited to accredited investors. That is, broadly, people with $250,000 in annual income and the expectation that their annual income will meet or exceed that goal, or people with a portfolio, an investable portfolio, in excess of $1 million. Not our rules. That's the government protecting you from yourself. A private placement is simply an issuance of securities, either debt or equity, from the issuer rather than an on-market transaction, meaning that you buy the securities from the company rather than from a different investor. Companies do private placements rather than public offerings because they're faster and cheaper. And they do the private placement to raise money to, hopefully, cause some profitable catalytic event to occur. The advantages for investors in private placements are several. The first is, by talking to the company and understanding why they raised the money, often you can take some of the time question out of holding the investment because they are raising the money for some potentially catalytic event. And understanding what the event is, what the most exciting potential development in the company is, what the probability of success is, what time it might take to come to occur, and what it might be worth, what you are doing is focusing your investments in more time-sensitive circumstances than in other forms of investing. The second advantage of a private placement is that in a thinly held security, sometimes to build the sort of position that we need, at least at Sprott, to move the dial, is the fact that we can buy fairly large amounts of securities without moving the market is of benefit to us, probably of less benefit to individual investors. But the most important incentive in speculative circumstances and in equity investments is the inclusion in a private placement of a warrant. The warrant is the right, but not the obligation, to buy more stock at a fixed price for a fixed period of time. The importance of this is that if the capital that you have contributed is contributed in the hopes of some catalytic change, if the investment that the company makes with the capital that you contributed is successful, and the consequence of that is that all shareholders benefit from an increase in the share price, having the right to buy more shares at a fixed price after this catalytic event has occurred can be extremely, extremely lucrative. I've had several circumstances in my life where I've made private placement investments and where the capital that I have invested has allowed the company to accrue sort of quantum increases in value, where I was able to materially improve the outcome of the investment by exercising the warrant. If you think about it, to make the math simple, a private placement where in the private placement you get a share at a dollar and a warrant that's exercisable at $1.50. If the stock were to go to $2, of course, you make a dollar on the share, but you also make 50 cents on the warrant, which means that you have turned a dollar profit into a $1.50 profit on that same investment. So the arithmetic is fairly obvious. The downside of private placements, of course, is that often when you make the private placement, the securities that you receive are restricted, which is to say that you aren't able to sell them for some period of time. It might be in the case of Canadian securities, 4 months, or in the United States, a year. So there are downsides to private placements too. You have to juxtapose the upside to the downside. But the truth is, in the speculative side of the ledger, I would say that the primary determinant of my outperformance relative to other speculators' outperformance is my concentration over 4 decades on private placements and the occasional, I don't know how else to describe it, insane or disproportionate return I've gotten from warrants.
So presumably that's something that people have to kind of, they can't do themselves, right? They can't just go and, it sounds like what you did back then was you just went to the company and said, hey, here's what I want to do. But it sounds like that's not something that everybody can do.
Well, to be honest, Kirk, while I would prefer to be every investor's gatekeeper in the world, it's profitable for me. That isn't necessarily the truth. If your listeners and readers are involved in small cap or micro cap companies that are not yet generating substantial amounts of retained earnings, that is where it's likely that they will require additional capitalization. One thing that investors can do is get in touch with the corporate development or investor relations people at the company and say, if the time comes that you're looking to raise more capital and you're going to do it by a private placement, given that I'm already a shareholder and I already know the story, I would be very interested in participating. Doesn't work every time. But the truth is, it's free to find out. The more important determinant for that person would be their ability to determine from their own point of view what the value proposition was that was offered up by the private placement. That's the place where somebody like Sprott, with lots of geologists and lots of engineers and lots of financial analysts, can probably help.
Nice. As we kind of wrap up, I wanted to talk about a few final things. So one is, and this will probably segue into the other one, you know, given where we are now in the cycle and where natural resources are, where do you see the biggest opportunities right now?
In the near term, 1 or 2 years, I see it in precious metals, both physical precious metals and in the precious metals equities. I would say in the near term, gold. And the reason for that is simple arithmetic. There are many things that move the gold price, most of them having to do with fear. But the most important, in my experience in the gold market, has been fear concerning the ongoing purchasing power of various fiat currencies, most importantly being the world's reserve currency, that is the US dollar, and specifically being the sanctity of purchasing power involving purchasing the US 10-year treasury, which is the world's benchmark security. And here the arithmetic is troubling. The market and the US government propose to pay you, if my memory serves me right, about 1.67% a year on the 10-year treasury. The problem with that is that the consumer price index, the cost of living, is, according to the government, increasing at 1.6% a year. So the value proposition associated with the U.S. 10-year treasury is that they propose to pay you 7 basis points a year, storing your money for 10 years. Now, that's a good promise compared to other governments in the world. European governments, as an example, for the first time in recorded history, are telling their citizens the truth. With negative interest rates, they're promising their citizens that if the citizens give the government the money, the government will give them back less than they originally gave them. Jim Grant calls that return-free risk. Hence, the fear of the sanctity of the purchasing power. in these bonds with artificially low interest rates is challenged. But there's more math too, as a US person looking at gold. That arithmetic goes like this. The on-balance sheet liabilities of the US government, that is, the debt owed to bondholders, exceeds $22 trillion. That's 22 with 12 zeros off it. The Congressional Budget Office estimates of the off-balance sheet liabilities, things like the Social Security Trust Fund, Medicare, the Environmental Defense Trust Fund, exceeds $100 trillion. So at the federal level, not including state debt, not including local debt, not including corporate debt, not including individual debt, not including unfunded pension funds, exceeds $120 trillion. We propose to service that debt with the national income, which is to say taxes and fees minus expenses. The problem with that is that the national income last year was a negative $1.4 trillion. Now, your listeners need to ask themselves how you add a column of negative numbers and come up with a positive sum sufficient to service $120 trillion in debt. And the truth is, it can't be done. That's the second piece of arithmetic that suggests that gold might be a good alternative to the U.S. dollar or U.S. 10-year treasuries. The third piece of arithmetic, Kirk, goes like this. At present, precious metals and precious metals-related investments comprise between one-third of 1% and one-half of 1% of the investment and savings matrix in the United States. That is, their market share of investable assets in the United States is less than one-half of 1%. The last time gold was popular in 1981, that same number was 7%, or 14 times as high. Now, I'm not suggesting to you that gold's market share will increase to where it was in 1981, nor am I suggesting to you that gold is going to replace the U.S. dollar or the U.S. 10-year treasury. What I'm suggesting is that the three-decade mean market share of precious metals and precious metals-related assets was 2% of the savings matrix in the United States. And if we experience mean reversion, we increase demand for precious metals and precious metals-related assets fourfold in the world's biggest economy. And that's precisely what I think is going to occur. If you look at the Barron's Gold Mining Index chart, which goes back 40-something years, you will see 7 or 8 periods of oversold bottoms. And you will see that where we are now with regards to those indexes in a historical context is approaching the bottom, at the bottom, or just off the bottom. You will see, too, that the durations of the bottoms vary between 2 years and 4 years. The bottom that we're in now, the cyclical bottom, began in 2012. We're, of course, now in 2020. So it's arguable that this bottom is very long of tooth. What you will also see is that the recoveries, the measured recoveries over the last 40 years from oversold bottoms have varied between 180% up and 1,200% up. So when you take into account the fact that the value proposition offered up by the U.S. dollar is historically lousy, as is evidenced by very low interest rates, when you look at the debt and deficit and understand that the only way probably that we service that debt is by devaluing the denominator over time, and you look at the historic returns that can be and have been realized in gold equities off of oversold bottoms, the case for intelligent investing in precious metals and precious metals equities, I suggest, would be very strong.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with your thesis. And I think the question always comes to mind, though, just being a devil's advocate here, right? So back in the 80s, 70s, you know, when gold was played a different part in our financial system, whereas now it plays a much lesser part in the financial system, does it still have the same appeal if it's not bound to our dollar like it was, you know, decades ago?
I would suggest that it's not the answer. I would suggest that it's an answer. One of the mistakes that people make when they fall into the gold narrative is that they go overboard. The truth is that if you regard gold as an insurance asset, when gold moves, a little bit goes a long way. I'm not suggesting that your listeners go 40% or 50% or 100% into gold. I'm suggesting that probably most of your listeners have no gold exposure whatsoever. And I'm suggesting that the market share of precious metals and precious metals equities across the savings and investment matrix in the United States being south of 0.5% ought to be 2%. That's all I'm suggesting.
Okay. No, I can certainly buy that. I think that's a reasonable thesis. And I think if you look at, I mean, personally, if I look at it and say, well, if there's enough investors who see gold as an opportunity, then that's what rights the ship, right? That's the reversion to the mean when enough people see the thesis there.
It's interesting when people talk about gold that the price action of gold over 40 years justifies the narrative. When people look at the 10-year U.S. Treasury, the same thing happens, too, from a different point of view. The U.S. 10-year Treasury has been in a bull market since 1982. The ascribed price of the bond, of course, varying inversely with the interest yield. In 1982, the bond was yielding 15.6%. Now the bond yields 1.6. One must ask oneself whether the U.S. 10-year Treasury is closer to the beginning or to the end of a 35-year bull market. And if you believe that gold and gold equities trade in some measure inversely to the U.S. 10-year Treasury, it is easy to suggest that while the narrative in the bond is fully played out, that the narrative in gold is just beginning.
Well, I could tell you, Rick, that if we're not close to the end of that market, I'm going to be very scared.
Well, we could go to negative interest rates, of course. It's worked in other countries. And, you know, Americans want to believe in their government. They want to believe in their dollar. They want to believe in the economy. And if we went to negative interest rates, our government would be telling us the truth, too. They would acknowledge that when you give them money, they're going to give you back less of it. It's what they've always done. But it would be nice to formalize it.
Well, in case the listeners didn't get your joke, are there any countries who have actually made negative interest rates work?
If you can believe it, right now, Greek debt sells at a negative interest rate. The world bond markets are, from my point of view, crazy. A couple of years ago, the Argentines managed to sell a 100-year bond.
Oh, God, I remember
that. If you look back in history, in the last 100 years, the Argentines have defaulted 8 times in 100 years. This is incomprehensible to me. But I'm not telling people not to buy bonds. I'm just trying to say that people need to look at the totality of their portfolio and apply adult supervision.
Yeah, well, I don't think we can count on the politicians to be adults. I think we can all give up on that. Well, one final question. I'll let you go here. I appreciate you spending the time with us. I've noticed for quite some time, and you mentioned this earlier in the conversation about uranium. I'm curious in your thoughts of uranium because I've been reading a lot about this phase 4 reactors and the fact that it solves a lot of problems and uranium prices are still kind of in the doldrums. So what are your thoughts on uranium?
In the long term, by long term, I mean 4 or 5 years, new reactor construction in places like China, Taiwan, Korea, the Gulf states will take care of itself. In the near term, the price will be set by the pace of Japanese restarts. The oversupply in the market occurred as a direct consequence of Fukushima and, to a lesser degree, the demobilization of part of the German nuclear fleet. So in the next 18 to 24 months, I would say that the price of uranium will be determined by the pace of Japanese restarts, which thus far have been glacial. Japan Inc., that is the PRI government and the big companies in Japan, actively would like to restart the nuclear fleet. The Japanese people, particularly people who live in the vicinities of plants that have been shut down, believe that the Japanese government lied to them about the risks associated with Fukushima. So the restarts are politically unpopular in Japan. I would suggest that investors who are interested in the thesis, if they are private placement investors, hold their powder, that is, invest in the smaller uranium companies only when they have to return to market to raise the survival capital that will allow them to get through to the part in time where increased global demand for uranium overcomes the current surplus in inventories.
Well, I appreciate that commentary, Rick, and I certainly appreciate having you on the show, and I know the listeners will as well. So any kind of final thoughts, and then where can people find more about you and Sprott?
Well, a final thought probably has to do with commodities markets, which are, and I have a chart that shows this too, are at historic lows, and I suspect perhaps going even lower. I'm not saying this because I'm an economist. I'm not. I'm a credit analyst. I'm just very concerned myself about the fact that we're 10 years into an economic expansion, which in my experience has been very long of tooth, and concerned too, because I see that a lot of the expansion has been, at least from my point of view, due to unrealistically low interest rates, which forward shift demand. A commodity recovery is inevitable, but it's not imminent. Those are very different words. So I would ask your listeners to remember back to the beginning part of this interview, which says that you make money in cyclical businesses by buying industries where demand for the product is assured, but where the industry average pricing is less than the industry average cost of production. And that goes to commodities. I would also ask your listeners to remember that gold and then silver are probably the most topical of the commodities for reasons that we've discussed. Now, I'm going to give your listeners an incentive to pay better attention. I have two charts available for your listeners. One, a 40-year chart of gold equities relative to other asset classes, and the second, a 100-year commodity chart. I will make those available to your investors, along with, for those listeners of yours that have a natural resource portfolio, a voluntary ranking of their portfolios. If your listeners will send me an email with the names and symbols of their natural resource holdings in the text, not as an attachment, but rather in the text, I will rank those companies 1 to 10, 1 being best, 10 being worst, and comment where appropriate on the companies. And I will send that back to the listener along with copies of the gold mining share index and the commodities chart. You can send this request to rankings, RANKINGS, at SproutGlobal.com. And I will personally rank the holdings where I know the company. I should put that caveat in. Please don't include, you know, supermarket stocks or technology stocks or things where I have less appreciation for my own ability to add value.
Well, that's very gracious, Rick. I appreciate you doing that for our listeners. And I highly encourage our listeners to do that. I mean, Rick is probably one of the brightest minds in the natural resource space. So take advantage of this offer while you can. It costs you nothing. So it's great. Well, thanks for coming on the show, Rick. This has been awesome. I appreciate your time and, you know, educating our listeners here.
Well, thank you. And thank you particularly for the thought you put into the questions. It was fun.
Wow. So that was a great episode with Rick Rule. I love Rick. I followed Rick's work for 20 years now. He just does really good work in the natural resource sector, and it's a really hard sector to get your arms around. So I'm glad we were able to get him on the show. So let's get to the panel portion of the show. This week we have Barbara Friedberg. How are you doing today, Barb?
Doing good, Kirk. How are you?
I'm doing great. And we also have Megan Gorman. How you doing, Megan?
Hi, Kirk. I'm doing well. And one thing, Barb and I are in lockdown, so because we live in the San Francisco Bay Area.
It's official. It's day 3 of the lockdown here. I know this is going live about 2-3 weeks from now, but it is day 3 of the lockdown, and we're already going stir crazy. So
yes, reporting from our bunkers in the Bay.
Awesome. So. Well, I'm sure you'll all probably be going much more crazy in a few weeks by the time this goes live. But yeah, we may be having drinks on the show in the next few episodes just to make it fun. Let's kind of dig in here because this is an interesting episode with Rick. You know, we were talking a little bit before the show about this, and there's some really good takeaways from the show for a lot of listeners. You know, as a sector, it's always been really intriguing to a lot of people. So, Barb, what are your thoughts on this? I mean, I certainly love the natural resource sector, but it's very trendy. And what are your thoughts on this sector?
I have never been a big fan of natural resources for the simple reason that you have no dividends on those and you have no growth per se. What you're really doing is you are betting on the ups and downs of the market, the supply and demand. So let me just say, I loved the episode. I think Rick sounds like a genius. I'm not suggesting anyone either invest or not invest in this sector, but it's very, very different from investing in publicly traded equities where you have a company behind your investment. So that's my take on it.
All right. What about you, Megan? What are your thoughts on this sector?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I thought Rick was fascinating. It was interesting to learn about this area a bit more. You know, from an investment perspective, like Barb, I have never been a huge advocate of investing in natural resources. That being said, what I've learned in working in the high net worth space is people have different interests and want different things in their portfolio. So, you know, like I was just in just hearing Barb's answer, I didn't even think about the dividend thing. That's important to her as an investor. So I find that when people are interested in these types of sectors, it's important to think about your asset allocation strategically, right, with the main asset classes. But what you really have to do is figure out, okay, where do I want to be tactical and maybe make a tilt to a certain area? And so this type of, you know, investing is sometimes where I could see a client wanting to have a tilt to, particularly if they could invest with someone like Rick. Now, for, you know, the typical investor out there on the street, you have to think about things a little more practically, which is if you are interested in something like natural resources or oil or gold, is can you get that exposure in a more efficient manner? And so that's where I would think about looking at things like ETFs to get this type of exposure. But really, you know, as I was listening to him and I was thinking about portfolio construction, I kept thinking to myself, this is a 1% tilt for most people in a portfolio. This is not an entire portfolio, but it's a, hey, let's sort of lean in this direction just a little bit to see what it's all about. And for some people, 1% may be $1,000 of their portfolio. For others, it can be 500,000. It's understanding that you have to have your core investment portfolio and then you can do these unique things.
Yeah, I like this line of thinking because I think that, you know, what I've seen kind of in my practice is because we specialize in alternatives, we get a lot of people who want to invest in gold and cryptocurrency and stuff like that. You know, so we get a lot of gold investors or gold bugs, as they're called. And the takeaway I usually give them is this. The natural resource sector, whether it's precious metals or other mining operations, or if you're talking about oil and gas, they tend to be cyclical. You tend to have trends where they're trending strongly, and then there are times like as of, you know, this week or when we're taping here, where they're very weak, and or at least oil is. And if you're investing for the long term, then you're probably going to be disappointed. You want to be in the sector when it's trending up, and when it's trending down, you don't. And I know that's kind of a simplified version of buying low and selling high, but effectively, you don't want to be in them forever. You know, there's a few people like Rick and Doug Casey who was on before. Like during the bad times, it's really ugly. I mean, you could lose 90% of your money if you're buying at the peak and to the trough. I mean, some of the gold stocks, they lose 90% or more of the value. And that's completely normal. That's the problem. But when they go up hundreds and hundreds of percent. The thing is, as Megan said, you know, if you have money to invest with somebody like Rick, it's great. If you don't, then you really want to be more strategic with your investments. So let's talk about that. If you want to kind of break it down, the natural resources, there's the precious metal space, then there's other metals, and then there's kind of oil and gas. How do you invest, Barb, or how would you recommend people kind of look at this area?
Well, first I'd like to tell a story. Last year, I opened a simple IRA, which is an IRA for my business, and I put in $15,000, and I intend to do the same this year. That money will grow for retirement. Well, I decided I'm just going to invest it with Schwab's Intelligent Portfolios Robo-Advisor. And so I just put it there, and they put together a portfolio in line with my risk tolerance. And I was looking at that portfolio yesterday, and it holds, maybe 10 different ETFs across various sectors. And it is the only place I have any gold in my portfolio. Granted, it's only maybe 2 or 3% of that portfolio, so it's not a lot of money at all. But I was noticing, and this is being taped on March 18th, I was noticing that given the tumultuous investment markets due to the coronavirus outbreak, all my other investments were down, which would be expected, except the gold. And so I bring that up because investing in these types of sectors can also be a counterweight because they're not as correlated as your typical stock investments, and even your U.S. and international stock investments are all rather closely correlated. So back to your question, Rick, how would you invest in those? I actually have a screen up now from an ETF database, and I'm looking at a natural resources ETF list. And I like these ETF databases, and I like investing in ETFs because although I used to pick individual stocks in the past, that's not where my interest lies right now. I don't want to do all the work and research. And so I don't think it's a bad idea, as Megan suggested, to put a small percentage of your portfolio in possibly an oil ETF, a gold ETF, a natural resources ETF, particularly when markets are down. Now, you might have to wait a while for a rebound, but as Kirk said, when markets come back, when they're cyclically in favor, you can experience outsized gains. And right now, oil per barrel, I think, tell me if I'm right, is trading somewhere around $30 a barrel, which is unbelievable.
24 this morning.
Oh my gosh. Yeah,
23 and a half right now.
Wow. So I haven't checked in a couple of days. So yeah. So I'm looking at this crude oil ETF list. Year to date, the non-hedged ETF funds, which means the funds that are not using derivatives to increase their returns, we've got year to date, the United States Oil Fund is down 55%. The Invesco DB Oil Fund is down 43%. So you're looking at a sector which is down really 50% since the beginning of the year. Now, I typically look at longer charts, and I pull up a chart that on Yahoo Finance or MarketWatch or Morningstar to see how it's trending. Oil is not going to stay that cheap. I mean, unless the end of the world is here, and then really it doesn't matter anyhow. That was a joke, guys.
Sorry, I was on mute. Sorry.
Okay.
I did laugh.
I don't want to incite panic with the Money to Invest podcast, but you know, unless the world is coming to an end, oil's going to rebound. So I'm not making advice for anyone to invest one way or the other, but all I'm doing is look, I am typically an index fund passive investor, but that doesn't mean with a certain portion of my portfolio, I won't take a speculative position in this asset class or that in an attempt to juice up my returns. So as Megan said, and as Kirk alluded to, yeah, I'd look at the ETFs in some of these beaten down sectors. And now is a hugely frightening time to invest. But now is the time, and I'm not talking about today, but during this time of market upheaval, is the time when money can be made investing when everybody else is scared.
I think that you're making a really good point there that everyone, right now, people are very frantic, right? And as someone who's client facing right now, part of my job is just, and I think Kirk's in the same situation, is just to remain calm and be a voice of reason. But I do think it is a good time to be investing. And some people think it is as well, and some people think that's a crazy thought right now. But I think if you're going to do any of this type of investing, particularly the nice thing with ETFs as they trade live, is what we're finding is clients are responding to better is dollar cost averaging. So if you decide you want to carve off 2% of your portfolio to be in a tilt to natural resources or to oil or to gold. What we would probably look at doing is sort of build out a plan so that you're not just buying in on one day, but you're buying in on a series of days to help mitigate some of the risk. But I think ETFs for most people are the way to go. I think for investors who are able to invest with Rick, and I don't know if he actually gave his minimum. Did he say what his minimum was for his managed accounts?
He didn't say on the podcast, but I went on his website, and his website's pretty interesting. Although I have to admit, the offerings he has range from a whole variety of different types of investments. But yeah, his website is very good, and we can put that in the show notes. So if you want to check it out, you can look at it.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things, you know, in working with the high net worth group that they are very good at doing when they come upon these types of investments, and I'm not just talking about Rick's firm, but anything from private equity to hedge funds to even angel investing, is they are willing to follow a due diligence process. And so this is something I think when you get into these more complex investments, you really need to make sure you have. And it's good to sometimes have an advocate who's looking at investments for you when you bring them to them to do the due diligence. And what due diligence really is you want someone kicking the tires on the investment. So you want someone to be talking them to them institution to institution and really understand what is their strategy, what is their philosophy, how do they execute, what is the processes internally. And these seem like obvious things, but I have been on due diligence calls where it is very clear as you start to ask the second or third question that there really isn't a strong process in place. And that should make you wary of investing. Now, if you're in the ETF world, the good thing is there is process. But when you're looking at separate managers, focusing on due diligence is key. The other thing is understanding things like minimums, lockups, and fees. So in the ETF world, it's pretty straightforward. You can buy and sell with the market. You know, most ETFs, I think, in this space, and Barb, tell me if I'm wrong, but I think most of them are ranging between 15 and 30 basis points. What you see is what you get. But when you're looking at more of the private investment side or some of these investment managers, you have to ask these questions about what their fees are, what's the structure, how does it work, what's your minimum, how easily can you get access to the monies? And then, and most importantly, for tax purposes, are you going to get a 1099 or a K-1? Because you'd be surprised as you start to go into some of these investments that all of a sudden it's not a 1099 investment. You're now waiting for a K-1. And this is not uncommon in the commodity space.
Yeah, that's actually a great point that you rarely hear people talk about. And people always get frustrated when they get K-1s, or more frequently, they don't know they're getting a K-1, they file their taxes, and then they get the K-1, then they get all upset. So yeah. The K-1s in themselves is not a big deal, but I think for a lot of people, it just creates another layer of frustration. Their investments, and at some point, we'll probably bring somebody on to talk about these, but they call them MLPs or Master Limited Partnerships, which frequently, if not always, have K-1s distributed. Now, there are some tax benefits to those, which is why people invest in them. But generally speaking, it's also a little bit more frustrating. And I think that...
Kirk, I should just jump in there as a tax person.
Yeah.
I get MLP. I have clients invest in MLPs. It is not uncommon for us to get 20, 30, 40 K-1s for each MLP. So if you go into an MLP, you need to be prepared for the cost of your tax return to go up and be really nice to your tax person, because they are miserable for us to input.
Yeah. And to make things even more interesting is if you're investing in those inside of a retirement account, your accountant's going to really hate you if you do that.
So. Yep.
But some of them are interesting, because if you look back in 2008, 9, and 10, you could get them for, some of them were trading at like 20, 30% yields because they were just decimated from the drop in the markets. And it wasn't warranted at the time. So what was interesting was you're getting these huge yields, and you obviously, you know, from a tax perspective was more complex, but, you know, it made sense overall. But I think right now oil's is lower than it's been in the last 12 years at least. I don't know. I'm trying to think when the last time oil prices have been at $23.50. It's been a long time. So it's interesting. And I think from the natural resource space, at least the way I look at it is, you're investing in a terrible business. If you're investing in mining companies, it's a terrible business. Even oil companies is a terrible business, right? You have a fixed resource that's going to eventually deplete completely, you know, and then you have price volatility that changes. So you're taking a gamble in some sense. Now, if you're somebody like Rick who gets into the fundamentals and really understands the math, which I will tell you is quite complex for certain companies, like if you don't know mining, it's not easy. I know some people that do it really well, and that's all they do. For them, it's easy, but they're going out and visiting the mines. They're talking with the operators, and some of these mines are in really isolated places. So some people like Rick, and there's a few others that do this well, they're really, you know, boots on the ground kind of research, and they do well for it. But, you know, when it's not trending in your direction, you just have to be really cautious because it's really easy to lose money if you're reading a newsletter and you're saying, hey, this is going to go up 300%. Well, maybe. If you don't know what you're doing, then you know, maybe it won't. But let's kind of break these apart because I think there's obviously a difference between oil and gold right now. And gold seems to be trending strongly and oil not so much. Barb, when you look at these, when you're looking at portfolios, do you kind of make a difference between the two in natural resources, or are you kind of looking at each one independently?
Oh, absolutely. I think the precious metals are in a class by themselves. I don't think you can throw them in with the oil and the other natural resources because, as Rick said in the conversation prior to this, investors go towards gold when there's uncertainty, when there's fear, and there can be periods of time where gold does nothing. I mean, I learned investing from my dad. He had a gold stock, and it literally did nothing for 20 years. He finally sold it, and then it went up, which, you know, of course, that's great, right? But you invest in something like precious metals, again, there's no dividends, there's no appreciation. It is a cyclical metal. And because it was the basis of our currency for many years and is very scarce and is highly valued, you can expect gold to go up during times of fear and uncertainty. But like precious metals and like some of these, I would say, more speculative alternative types of investments, you might have your own reasons for investing in those. But I would caution you, unless you are very, very young and have a lot of years to recoup any losses or are a trader or are very speculative, to just carve out a portion of your portfolio. And if you're scared and you think, wow, gold's going to go up, I'm going to buy some and it'll be sort of a hedge against the volatility of the other investment markets, okay, give it a try. I wouldn't get into buying physical gold. I'd buy a gold ETF. I believe in just keeping investing as simple as you can. Natural resources are different. People don't go to those for security. It's like, oh yeah, I'm going to buy a timber ETF or something like that. The world's coming to an end. No, and those you just buy on the cyclical nature of the industry and buy in with the idea that you will get some appreciation at some point.
Yeah, and one thing to point out to play off what you said, Barb, is the way that you invest in some of these resources. Like, in, you know, if you were to invest in oil, in an oil ETF, you'd effectively be investing in futures contracts. Whereas if you're investing in a gold ETF, you're, at least in some cases, it depends on the gold ETF or closed-end fund, because there are some of those as well. Some of those actually have gold in a vault, so you're not investing in the futures. Now, the futures can create some dynamics which are not necessarily in your favor of owning it just because of the, you know, the backwardation or the contango, or there's all these other things which I won't get into here, but there are reasons why it's not a good thing. So some of the gold ETFs that own the gold are they're just sitting in a vault, and it's much simpler type of ownership. one thing that comes up a lot with gold bugs is they want to own the physical, because the whole point of it, as you said, Barb, is, you know, it's a protection against a lot of different things. Some people call it a chaos hedge, if you will. It protects against devaluing the currency, it protects against inflation, lots of reasons that people buy it. So they want to own the physical because they want to own it and they want that sense of protection, which I get. And during times of calm, when the markets are acting normally, then you don't really need that. But it's in times like this, let's say, when things are a little bit crazy, that's when owning the physical is actually a little bit more important, because you want to make sure that the gold is actually there, which is the argument that a lot of the gold bugs make against ETFs. So Megan, what are your thoughts on the different resources?
Candidly, they're not an asset class that I'm particularly interested in investing in and don't steer my clients to. I did work at a firm for a period of time that always had an allocation to those investments. And, you know, during the time period I was there, obviously it was a very finite period. They never really seemed to do anything in the portfolio. So for me, it's not exactly where I would put my money. But, you know, if people really want to do it, one, don't do the ones you see on TV, the gold commercials. And two, I just think you've got to find something that's fairly diversified and easy to get in and out of. And I know that's sort of a dull answer, but I just don't find them compelling in a portfolio. And trust me, I'm an investor. There's a lot of stuff that excites me. Gold, not so much.
Yeah, no, I get that. I mean, gold has been trending strongly recently, but it definitely has its on and off periods. And I think usually the time when it starts to take off is when everyone's just like, ugh, you don't want to own gold.
right. They've given up. They've put up the white flag of surrender.
Yeah. I mean, that tends to be it. But when everyone's talking about it, that's usually, well, I guess it's true for anything, right? When the trend is, when the shoeshine boys are giving you stock tips, that's when you want to get out. And it's same thing with gold. When the cocktail parties, people are talking about how much Bitcoin they have or how much gold they have, that's usually the time to silently sell your position.
Right. I mean, look, these downturns, I mean, this is not fun to go through for anyone. I mean, maybe hedge fund traders are enjoying themselves right now, but
They're not.
But no one is enjoying this. But the thing about recessions and significant market pullbacks, you know, it really teaches us who we are as investors. And it's been interesting going through this again, because what I feel that a lot of people learned out of 08, 09, and I'm talking more about boomers and Xers, is they got a good understanding of who they are as investors. My experience is they're doing better this time around. I think it's going to be interesting as we go through this volatility, what the millennials experience, because they've been booming. You know, they probably have been buying ETFs in some of these sectors to sort of see what happens. And now they're, to quote Warren Buffett, they're seeing who's swimming naked. That's going to be interesting to see how they approach the markets going forward, because it was easy to invest in these funds when the whole market was doing well.
Yeah, I would agree. Well, let's wrap it up here. Barb, final thoughts from you on this, on investing in natural resources.
If you are so interested in diversifying in that direction, then just take a small percentage of your assets. And I would suggest just go broad and try an ETF. Otherwise, if you feel like it's not for you and you just want to stick with your standard stocks, bonds, fixed assets, in the long run, I think you're going to do fine. I would also like to say, although now is a period of a very down market and we don't know whether things are going to continue down further, it's quite likely they will. I liked Megan's advice at the beginning of the show, which is, now's the time that you might want to think about, if you have any extra capital, is to start dollar cost averaging, which means investing just a little bit of your money back into the markets, because they will rebound, at least if, you know, hundreds of years of history continue, they will rebound and you will be happy that you did over the long term, because this is a chance when you can actually buy assets on sale. So just like you to remain calm during these tumultuous markets. And if you want to check out investing in natural resources, there are ETFs that you can investigate. individual stocks if you're so inclined. And if you don't, I don't think you're going to miss out a huge amount if you avoid that sector.
Great. And where can people find more about you, Barb?
You can find me at RoboAdvisor Pros. And I particularly like RoboAdvisors or digital investment advisors now because they can take some of the emotion and anxiety out of investing for you. And Great. You can also find me at Barbara Friedberg, Personal Finance. Thank you, Kirk.
Yeah, thanks for coming on, Barb. Megan, what about you? Final thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I just pretty much ditto on what Barb says. You know, I think stick to strategic asset allocation. And for these types of investment decisions, you can make a tactical tilt of 1% to 2% of your portfolio. And look, due diligence is really, really important. So before you decide to do anything, really read up on it, study prospectuses, understand the key components, because that at least will give you, you know, a good understanding of what your risks are if you decide to invest in this asset class. You can find me at Wealth Intersect on Twitter, at The Wealth Intersection on Instagram, or www.thewealthintersection.com. Thanks for having me, Kirk.
Yeah, thanks for coming on, Megan. And to wrap up, my name is Kirk Chisholm, Wealth Manager at Innovative Advisor Group. We don't just manage your wealth, we make your life better. You can find more about me at innovativewealth.com. And of course, you can find me every week here on the show. So that's the show this week. Thanks for joining us on Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stay healthy and stay safe. Please remember to subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or Google Play. You can also check out the show at moneytreepodcast.com. We'll have all our show notes there, and you'll have access to all of the resources as well as other archive shows. And lastly, please leave a show rating and comments on the podcast app of your choice. When you subscribe and rate the show, it allows us to get better access to some of the top guests that you're going to want to hear. People like Rick and a few others that we've gotten on that are just really just phenomenal guests will be able to get more people like that. So have a great week ahead. And remember, no one will care about your money like you do. So invest in your life.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at moneytreepodcast.com for more free investing resources.